You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you. Hosted by Stacy Waite and Scott Winter.
I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips aglow in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. They are dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, "Stop, don't do it." She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you have not heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Her hungry, pretty face turning to me. Her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. His arrogant, handsome face turning to me. His pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. But I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips, like chips of flint, as if to strike sparks from them. I say, "Do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it."
He is Scott Winter.
And she's Stacy Waite. And that was Sharon Olds' classic confessional poem, I Go Back to May 1937, as read by Franny Sprowls.
We started with that poem because on today's show, we're talking with writers Julie Marie Wade and Natalie Diaz about family matters and writing about family. I got to interview both authors, and here's what Julie Marie Wade had to say about the connection between her own work and that Sharon Olds poem we just heard.
I've had this sort of ongoing romance with the subjunctive, and it's been supported by all kinds of writers. And I think maybe the first time it crystallized for me that you could sort of do that, that you could imagine this possible future that didn't look like anything you'd seen in the world around you, was when I read Sharon Olds' poem, I Go Back to May 1937. And I realized that was, you know, her chance to think about, you know, what if my parents hadn't gotten together and had me? And then I love that the poem becomes so tense around the, as if this really was a possibility, and as if she had really gone back and had the choice to prevent their union, and then the feeling of, but I don't want to do that, because if I do that, then I don't get my chance at a life. So, you know, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it at the end of that poem, really sounded to me like the memoirist sort of rallying cry, like, I'm going to look at these possibilities for what might have been. I'm going to consider all these different past possibilities, but I'm also going to try to tell what has actually happened. And then out of that, I think over time, I've also tried to possibilize other things, you know, like imagine the life that could be mine that I actually have the chance to make.
Julie Marie Wade is the author of two collections of lyric nonfiction, one called Wishbone, a memoir in fractures, another called Small Fires, and two collections of poetry, Without and Postage Due, which is forthcoming with White Pine Press in 2013. She's assistant professor of English at Florida International University, and here she is reading from Small Fires, from an essay entitled Bone.
"You'll never believe it," my mother exclaims, bursting in on me in the bath. I pull my knees up to my chest. I clutch my fists underwater. Someone has anonymously nominated you for the Miss Preteen America pageant. Me. Well, don't look so surprised. There's more to you than meets the eye, she beams, and this is your chance to prove it. Skeptically, what do I have to do? She consults the grainy cardstock from the envelope. First, you have to write an essay explaining why you are a good candidate to be Miss Preteen America, what you have to offer. What do I have to offer? My mother perches on the toilet seat, skimming the documents, but when I say this, she looks up at me and scowls. What do you mean, what do you have to offer? Poise, confidence, leadership ability. You are an ideal representative of America's preteen girls. That's unfortunate, I murmur, thinking of Katie Parker, her taut body of contradictions, strength and grace, power and elegance. Now my mother sticks her toe in the water and splashes my face. Am I hearing you right? You've been given the opportunity of a lifetime, and you're making light? Where does it lead? I mean, if I go to this pageant and I win, when you win, she corrects me, then what happens? Then you go on to compete for Miss Teen America, and from there, you could become Miss America. You could win a scholarship to college and be the envy of every young woman in the country. From the way she says it, raising these two possibilities like silver platters on her hands, I can't tell which she values more, the scholarship or the capacity to incite envy in others. You also have to send a picture and a resume detailing your accomplishments. That should be easy enough. You've done plenty of extracurricular activities and volunteer work with the church, and as far as the picture goes, inching her slippers back on her feet, I think I still have some 4x6 glossies from Yen Lui. Those are old pictures, I say. I'm 10 in them. You're thinner then, and you don't have acne.
Wow, that gives you a pause at the end there. But man, I really like that that image of her fists underwater and her mom saying there's more to you than meets the eye while she's in there naked in the tub.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful stuff. The whole book's actually pretty powerful. We talked both about that essay Bone that she read and about another essay called Skin. As Julie was describing what is for her the very visceral act of turning memory into art and then letting that art fall into the hands of others.
I think that there's the hardest part, at least for me, is the letting it out of your hands after it goes into the world. Because up until it goes into the world, there is a way that it feels very your own. And even if it's being shared in a workshop or, you know, in a small group, you still feel kind of like, you know, you own it. And that's true whether it's memoir that you're writing or not. But then when it leaves you, you know, you open yourself up in a lot of ways to, you know, so what if someone reads this narrative and really condemns the speaker who is, you know, closely identified with yourself, your most intimate self, you know, for being a bad daughter or for not trying hard enough to reconcile with her parents or, you know, any number of things that the reader could feel about this person, and then you no longer get to control that. And I think that's hard, and the best thing I can do is try not to speculate or worry too much about what readers might be, how I might be judged by a reader, hope for their empathy and understanding.
It's interesting, both of our authors today talked about what happens when this very personal work about family leaves their hands and enters the world. Stacy got to talk with poet Natalie Diaz, who talks about an interaction she had with her mother after her book, When My Brother Was an Aztec, was published. This is a moment when family isn't just written about, but becomes the place where words end up after they leave the writer's hands.
My mother and my sister came over, again, my youngest sister. And I could tell, you know, my mom had a lot in her and a lot to say, and she wasn't saying it. So finally, you know, it was just quiet. They were sitting in my living room quietly, and I said, well, Mom, I can tell you have something to say. Why don't you just say it? And she goes, well, I don't really have anything to say, but, I mean, that's just not how it happened. You know, the things you wrote in there, that's not how they happened. And so my youngest sister, like, very defensively, she said, Mom, what do you mean? What do you mean? That's exactly how it happened. And so that just kind of struck me because, you know, they're both right and they're both wrong. And this kind of goes back to us saying, yes, it's autobiography, but it's not true. And so hearing my mother say that and then my little sister, you know, that really twisted my head a little bit around thinking. And I think that's actually probably one of the reasons why these poems had to come out of me, you know, because for so long we dealt with it and we learned that it was normal and we just kept going with it and, you know. And so hearing my little sister say that, it just made me realize that we probably all have very similar poems in us to spit out about some of these things.
Let me tell you a little bit about Natalie Diaz. After playing professional basketball in Europe and Asia for several years, she completed an MFA at Old Dominion University. Diaz lives in Mojave Valley, Arizona, and directs a language revitalization program with the last elder speakers of the Mojave language. As Scott mentioned, Natalie Diaz is the author of the poetry collection When My Brother Was an Aztec. Natalie read from a poem in that collection and the poem's called Black Magic Brother.
My brother, my mago, the consummate professional, he is dependable, performs daily, nightly in the living room, a forever matinee, an always late shaman show. Come one, come all, behold the spectacle of the Prince of Prestidigitators. As the main attraction, drumroll please, he pulls animals from a hole in his crotch. You thought I'd say hat. But you don't know my black magic brother. And those animals love him like the first animals loved God when he gave them names. My brother, our perpetual encore. He riddles my father with red silk scarves before sawing him in half with a steak knife. Now we have two fathers. One who weeps any time he hears the word presto. The other who drags his feet down the hall at night. Neither has the stomach for steak anymore. My mother, too, is gone somewhere, in one of the pockets of my brother's bluest tuxedo, abracadabrantesque. The audience is we. We have the stubs to prove it, and we have been here for years, in velvet chairs the color of wounds, waiting for something to fall. Maybe the curtain, maybe the crucifix on the wall, or maybe the pretty white doves my brother made disappear. Now we see them, now we don't. We'll fall from his sleeves like angels, right before our very eyes.
We talked quite a bit about the anxiety a lot of poets feel about truth and autobiography in their work. Certainly the poet we opened with today, Sharon Olds, has been part of the ongoing conversation about confessional poetry, poetry and autobiography. I asked Diaz about that complicated relationship.
When we're talking about poetry, autobiography, it's become kind of a dirty word. It's become confessional, another dirty word. You know, girl writing, kind of, I think, is how I've heard it, you know, talked about in the past and thrown around in terms of what it means. And I think our autobiographical poems, they're almost like a weakness in poetry. It's kind of like, your poetic imagination wasn't good enough, so, you resorted to the truth of family, you know, or something along those lines. But, I mean, for me, I think every poem you write is autobiographical. I don't understand how it could be anything but that. These are the words and images that my life has fed me in some respect. And so, you know, in my head, in my subconscious, in my, you know, that's me, that's who I am. And so whatever I'm putting back out, it's autobiography. Once we see a poem, and if it is autobiographical, if we can attach it to points of ourself, I think some people are a little self-conscious about that, of seeing at least a recognizable part of who they are outside of themselves, outside of their, you know, their physical body. There's a poem sitting there and it's got you all over it.
I think all writers, no matter what the genre, even artists, no matter what the medium, all have to deal with what happens when we publish truth.
Yeah, or have to deal with the question of, is that true, or in what ways is this true, or what kind of truth is it? I think those are fascinating questions, particularly when it comes to what we were talking about on today's show, family. We appreciate you listening to Air Schooner today. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening.
Want to enjoy Prairie Schooner on an e-reader? Now you can. Visit Amazon.com to buy the current issue of Prairie Schooner for only $6.99. Air Schooner is available on iTunes. Sign up now to subscribe. You'll be the first of your hip friends to get the latest episode, and you can download all past episodes all the way back to the premiere show, featuring Nulani Krohor's Irish poetry.
Air Schooner is a bi-weekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from James Redd, Ted Wheeler, and Marianne Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson and Franny Sprowls. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's College of Journalism and Mass Communications. Air Schooner is produced by Scott Winter and the brainchild of executive producer Kwame Dawes.